Thank you, everyone, for joining us. My name is Jennifer Cohane, and I'm one of the co-founders of CARP. CARP is a loose collection of international and interdisciplinary scholars that are studying character and character assassination across the realms of politics, science, and entertainment. And we'll see primarily character assassination at play from a political perspective today. We host conferences dedicated to the subject, publish scholarship about character assassination, and teach courses, workshops, and seminars. Last thing I want to tell you before I turn it over to Dr. Shirai is that we tweet about upcoming webinars, so you can find out more about those by following us on Twitter at CARP_lab. Thanks, and enjoy our conversation.
Well, hello, welcome back to all of you. We are now today just happy to discuss things. And in fact, I am happy to discuss things with Jason Smart. Jason is a graduate of George Mason University. Jason studied there, well, we can say a long time ago. one of his professors there, and there we met. And there we began talking about campaigning, politics, and national relations, and we became colleagues and I would say friends. And I've known Jason for many years now. Jason was working in many countries after that. He was working for National Republican Institute. It's a bipartisan group, which was sponsored by US Congress. And so one of the goals of this group was to essentially help developing democracies develop democracies. Well, through that, Jason was able to work in several continents, in many countries. And in fact, we'll talk about these. Jason has a doctorate degree. He's a political scientist. But in my humble opinion, Jason, not only is he a political scientist, he's also a great researcher and he's a sociologist. He knows psychology, he knows history. And so his experiences, it's interesting and great. And this is something which we'll learn today. And I learned myself. Long time ago, also, Lee Siegelman, former editor-in-chief of American Political Science Review, talked to me about negative campaigning and about negativism. And we talked about the ethics of negative campaigning. And I said, look, it's not good. Politics is supposed to be, it's about motivation. It's about facts. It's about reasoning. It's about competition of ideas. He said, yes, true. However, negativism works. And that's why there's, well, those campaigns go negative. That's why there's a character attacks in politics, because they do work. And our function is to learn to see what they do, how to defend against those character attacks, and somehow how to help ourselves to sustain the pressure of character attacks, not only in politics, but also in our life. Jason, welcome. Can you hear me well?
I hear you well, Eric. Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Good to see you.
Thank you. Dr. Smart, Jason, may I call you Jason? tell us, enlighten us, why do some character attacks work and others don't?
You know, I think that there's a combination of factors. And I think that if you look back on it, both in pragmatic, the experience of having worked in politics, but also what the research shows is how apt is the population to accept the information that they're receiving? I mean, does it seem realistic? Does it not seem realistic? And is a good media cycle for it? For instance, there was years and years and years of women who complained about things that were now that developed and only became scandals in the Me Too era. Why is that? Because the population was apt to hear that. They were open to hearing that. There was something that was all of a sudden interesting, like Harvey Weinstein. People had made accusations against him for years, but why was it only then that it became his downfall? It is the population was already incredibly interested in that specific issue. Allegations today of racism, for instance, are all of a sudden with a much greater impact than they would have had even 6 months ago. So I think it depends on the media cycle that you're in at that point, coupled with whether or not there is a public interest to receive more information about that subject.
Well, you mentioned about cycles, media cycles. It's a very interesting point. And you mentioned about Harvey Weinstein and, again, the race and talk about gender in the past. But do you think that character attacks are, well, there are common, but do you think they're more common these years, this decade compared to previous decade, or say 1990s, or as common as they have been in the past?
You know, I think that it is being accelerated. And one of the greatest accelerators, as everybody knows, is simply the use of the internet. The fact that so much now is digitalized. It is so much faster to go in and to find information that's negative about somebody, to find articles that were written 20 years ago. It's no longer seeing the library for days looking through microfiche about a quote from 1987. Today, it's been digitized. So simply the ability to find old information is much easier. Before, you'd have to do a lot of the hard work of going around trying to find people that knew him back in the day. Today, via his social media network, you could find who he used to know and begin contacting people or what they've posted, that I knew him when he was in college and he was a terrible guy. Well, maybe you, as a reporter, could reach out to that guy because he's probably going to give you some dirt. It's much easier today to network to find information that could be used in a potential character assassination attempt.
Jason, may I reveal some secrets? I don't think they're secrets, but you worked for a national presidential campaign and you work in a decision-making position. You worked in Ukraine, you worked in Lithuania, you work in Moldova, you work in Kyrgyzstan, and you can continue and you tell us, but how does it work? Do you do opposition research in the campaign? Do they do that? Do they have people who get together in a smoke-filled room and just smoke about, talk about, let's dig out some dirt on opposition? How does it work?
You know, it is interesting. I would argue that it's differs quite a bit between the United States and other countries. In the case of the United States, there is actually an entire aspect of a campaign called opposition research. That is a branch of the campaign. And it's been that way forever. My first job in politics was probably 1999, 2000-ish. And I was working for a candidate doing just that, opposition research, where you were literally sitting in the library going through microfiche and looking through old articles and old things that they've said, so you can figure out where they flip-flop, for instance, and how you can attack them with that in the campaign. But as time has progressed, in other countries, you see a difference. One, there's not that investment, but also there's not firm records like that. Typically, character attacks in other countries tend to be a lot more, I would say, and they've always been, more violent. And what I mean by that is, there's the use of hacking, for instance, to get sensitive information, something that really isn't commonly existent in the United States. There's the use of information that lawfare, for instance, where you prosecute somebody that's close to the candidate with the hopes that he will expose information about the candidate. And these sort of things don't happen in the U.S., fortunately, but it is very common in developing countries especially. So what the impact of that is that the character tax that you see in other countries can be very, very legally related. That is, it'll show corruption or it'll show something that's can be prosecuted. And that adds a whole new level to this, because no longer is it just simply it hurts someone's reputation, but then you can be prosecuted for what has been exposed.
But you're saying that there are, just speaking hypothetically, there are some people right here, students and graduate students, who may seek and find employment in U.S., for example, to do opposition research, right? Just to do just not just political science or facts, but just simply studying the facts about the person's biography.
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, for graduate students, I'd say sign up for Eric's class and you'll get a great job when you get out of college. It's a guarantee. It's a logical conclusion. But more than that, I think that there's an entire aspect, and this is, and the big people who use it, if you're interested, is in U.S. campaigns, the people that do the opposition research. So there are people who sit there and do the actual going through, digging through articles, and you know, you have the guy at the bottom who is collecting all this information, and it gets filtered up to the next guy who's going through and highlighting and fact-checking and seeing if that's true, that contrast with what was done other, and then it finally gets up to a guy who's an ad maker. An ad maker sitting there going, well, you know, this isn't really useful, nobody's going to believe that, or, oh, this one really has got a punch to it, we should really be putting more of an emphasis on that. And so you've got different people who are literally creating a project like any other. Instead of being a positive campaign, though, it's a negative campaign. And that is an entire aspect of political campaigns that is tremendously common. And we have to realize, though, as campaigns have changed, those attacks have also changed. I mean, I will reveal, I'm sure I was going to get to this point anyways, but which Eric didn't mention, which is I was the head of Cambridge Analytica in the United States for the campaign that I was assigned to the Cruz campaign. So we look at the presidential campaigns and how is character attacks used. One, Cambridge wasn't as scary as people think it was. But what it would do is no different than what polling did before that, which is different attacks have a different target audience. Not all attacks will be as equally offensive to the same people. For instance, a feminist woman is more likely to be offended by the attacks of he was a sexist or he didn't hire me as a woman 20 years ago than a 20-year-old guy who is more offended by the fact that this guy doesn't take young people seriously. So we have to look at which attacks can be more effective, and you hone it to that target audience that's most likely to have an impact with. Very few attacks are going to have an interest level for the entire population. That's what we see today with Donald Trump. there is constantly scandals coming out with Donald Trump, but why don't they have an impact? Why is he this solid base of people who love him? Because they are not the ones that can be persuaded by this. There are target demographics that can be persuaded, but you already have a huge number of people who already hate him, and it doesn't matter. Anything else is just extra grease on it for them. They already accept the fact that he's terrible. You don't have to convince them. But if you're talking about the target in a campaign, that's a target demographic. Those voters who are undecided and the toss-up voters in the toss-up states, what is it that interests them the most? What is it going to be the deciding factor that they see or hear that and they go, wow, that's just beyond my level of comprehension how somebody could do that. And I was planning to vote for him, but now I won't consider it any longer. The real goal of a character attack in campaigns would be that sort of demographic of people.
Well, you mentioned about the differences between U.S. campaigning, for instance, and campaigning in other countries and research opposition in those countries. But say you work in Kyrgyzstan. What is the most striking difference between, say, Kyrgyzstan, their politics, and U.S.? Of course, without mentioning names, but just what strikes you most?
Well, I mean, Kyrgyzstan is a good example of lawfare. I mean, the former president, Atambayev, was just sentenced 12 years in prison last week because of allegations of corruption, which were not really proven. Another leader of the opposition was also put into prison for inciting riots. He's an MIT grad for his MBA. It seems highly unlikely he was inciting riots. But this is what the government says. They create a rumor, and based upon the rumor that they themselves create, or that they leak to the press, and the press then reports, which then gives the prosecutor a justification to attack the person. They say, well, he's violent, he's unstable, we have to take him out of society because he's a threat to all of us. Now, it's absurd, but that's the way that it works, as you very well know. I mean, look at the history of the Soviet Union, same thing. Somebody was crazy. Being deemed crazy was more than just simply attacking their reputation. This was a means of then removing them from the society and putting them away so they would no longer be able to interact with the population. So it is the same sort of thing that we see now in other developing countries. How do you disqualify somebody more than just in the political way, but also in the juridical way? And this is how I think that one of the biggest differences you would see in somewhere like Kyrgyzstan or Ecuador, where I also work, is exactly that, that there is a use of political character assassination that has an entire basis to destroy the person beyond the level of just the reputation, which is the first step. Because once again, the audience has to be receptive. So if the audience accepts the fact, yes, he's corrupt, and they all have accepted this message, to then prosecute him is very acceptable to the population because they say, well, he's corrupt. They might not understand any of the details, but he's corrupt. And so they won't pay any attention when he gets locked away, and they don't say he's a political prisoner. They say, but he's corrupt. So the first step, though, is a successful character assassination if you want to be able to lock up your opponents.
Well, interesting. But I hear quite often from people in politics, and they speak out and say publicly that what, for example, what we do and what you do, what we do, is less relevant in real life, because if you're in politics, if you're a politician, if you stay clear just by your message, if your message is clear, if your policy is sound, nobody can crush your character. And my question to you, maybe we exaggerate, maybe character attacks are not that effective. Just we talk about them, but stay just like a breeze, which may be annoying, but doesn't really change the course of a ship.
Yeah, I think it really depends on who it is that's being attacked. And once again, it comes down to the receptiveness of the audience. Because if somebody has already decided that they're going to vote for someone no matter what, the character attack will not be effective. But if it is something and you are able to hit something on it that is sensitive to them personally, it could have a great impact. And I would cite, like any other thing, advertising, any other advertising in the world, not everybody who sees an ad to buy a car is going to buy a car. But there are people who are looking to buy a car today, and they're thinking, which model car should I buy? And they see your ad right then when they're considering which car to buy. They might very well then consider to go to the dealership and look at the car. But the vast majority of the people in the population, the ad's completely ineffective because I'm not considering buying a car. I'm not going to be persuaded by an ad. But I might be if I am already in that target demographic that's warmed up to it, that's thinking, yes, an ad, a car would be a great thing, and that model of the car looks like the right one. So character attacks only can be successful if you're able to connect with those people who are going to be open to it.
You mentioned about Ecuador and the Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine. I noticed you worked there. And you also said that media cycles and also public sensitivity. I know Martin X and I, we talked about thresholds, the points beyond which people become really angry or impatient or sensitive to particular issues, and they are political and cultural based. And as far as I think and I know, it's in Russia, the issue, any accusations of being sexist will be just go over people's heads, because unfortunately, right. It's a very sexist culture today, political culture, Russia. And these accusations will not be perceived by people as important ones. The argument would go, well, everybody's sexist, right? But in terms of the differences between, say, U.S. and Ecuador and U.S. And Kyrgyzstan, there must be some difference, right? Just in public perception, in public sensitivity to certain issues.
Sure. Everything does depend on local culture. I mean, local culture is the biggest thing. Is what is a character attack or what is something that's offensive than something that's in contrast to local norms and mores? And so if you're within the norms and the mores of your local population, there's nothing strange. But if you are outside of that, for instance, Kyrgyzstan, there was occasions of that. And I'll say Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan both, which I worked in, more in Kyrgyzstan, is that the rise of Islamic movements there. What was perceived as being the vast Kyrgyzstan is an incredibly secular country. That being said, is probably the most secular majority Muslim country, I'd imagine. But some of the things that would offend large demographics were things such as he drinks, such as things that he is not maintaining the fast that he should be maintaining. And that was offensive to demographics. Now, for someone who's secular, who cares that he's drinking? I drink too. And who cares he's not maintaining fast? I don't fast either. So obviously it doesn't have any impact on them. But for that target demographic that is maintaining the fast, who is not drinking, who is abstaining from pork, that is offensive. And so for them, yes, there is something that would be done. But that is, once again, the local mores that are the denominating factor here of why it has an impact or does not have an impact.
Jason, what, in today's world, and just continue the same subject, what has Trump changed in our culture, Trump and his presidency changed in our culture and in context of negativity and character attacks, in your view? And
he's such a positive and optimistic guy. I say it quite jokingly. No, you know, I have actually thought about that quite a bit. I think that one of the biggest things he's changed is two things. I think that we do see the limits of character attacks. There's a lot of things that Trump said and has done that, you know, if you go to the rule of thumb, everybody had said for years, for instance, when he said about John McCain, I like winners that don't get, I like, what is it, veterans that don't get caught, or whatever the phrase was, but you know what I'm referencing. I would have imagined for the Republican Party, especially, which is where I'm from, that would have been such a disqualifying thing to say that that would just blow him out of the water. I thought that would have, no, it doesn't have that impact. So I think it really changes the gauge of what really moves voters and what doesn't move voters. In the same way, I think that his overall negativity, because he is a very negative person, I think that's objectively true. If you look at his tweets or his statements, we can say that I think he's desensitized the population quite a bit. Because at this point, it is going to be much harder, at least for the coming period of time, to have an effective attack. And the reason it's going to be more harder is there's just so much negativity to begin with. What more does it add? In the case of Donald Trump, there's an interesting, you guys are well enough aware, the guys from CARP, is that one of the things that's interesting to the minds of voters or citizens is what is already cooked into their calculation. I mean, if you say tomorrow came out another audio tape where Donald Trump said something sexist, would that change one voter's mind in America? Would anybody be surprised whatsoever? Nobody would. It would be completely accepted. Yep. Would anyone doubt that the tape is real? No. Everybody would just immediately, one, accept that it's true. But secondly, it realistically not change their mind because they already know that's the sort of guy he is. So if that were to be Joe Biden, for instance, that would have perhaps a greater impact because nobody would expect that behavior from him. So it really does depend on who the person is being attacked. But also in the case of Trump, the degree that there's such negativity, I think it desensitizes the population to even attacks that are legitimate, things that should not be, they're not simply character attacks, legitimate concerns about his behavior are just sort of cast aside because he is just so routinely shown that he acts and behaves outside of the regular norms of political behavior.
You mentioned about desensitizing, and coincidentally, as a question, and by the way, we will address most of the questions, but we can do it right away because it's quite relevant, and some, it may be partially answered. And the question is, do you think that Trump has caused the issue of character to be less important to the citizenry? So less important. So it's just, as you said.
You know, I think so. I think that increasingly it is less important. And there was a degree that the United States, for years, I think was maintaining a very false narrative of what was important and not important. We always said publicly, for instance, well, you know, if it came out that he had done, John Kennedy was having affairs, that would have been the end. Perhaps in the 50s, yes. In the 60s, early 60s, yes. Today, I think that, you know, look at Italy, look at France. What is the role that something like this is, the personal life of the candidate? Minimal to none. And I think that we realize that citizens in the U.S. are really not much different. Though publicly, the media makes a big deal about this. Publicly, they think this is a big deal. In the eyes of the common person, the average guy, they don't really care. there's a small demographic that certainly does care. But I think that is a false, completely false, to believe that this is the end of the world. This will completely upset the cart. Realistically, it won't. People are quite forgiving. I mean, the one thing that they don't forgive is hypocrisy, though. If you're preaching one thing and doing something different, that is problematic. But if you are like Donald Trump, say, I don't care. I've been married 3 times and I lived with all these other women and I don't care. The population, obviously, as we've seen the polling numbers, can get past that pretty well, including demographics, evangelicals, who would not have guessed that before. But we see that voters here behave the same way as voters in European countries, Western European countries, is that they are quite forgiving and they're more interested in what the candidate's going to do for them than they are about his personal flaws.
Which brings it to the corresponding question, Jason. Trump is here. He is there for a few months or, four more years. But does it really mean that the next president could be a game changer, person with character, with a character, with a higher standards, for example, and then just we will go back to politics in which character will matter?
Well, I mean, you remember that when Carter got elected, this is the same thing. He's going to restore the integrity of the White House post Nixon and Watergate. And I do think that there's a valid statement to that. That being said, I think that the pretense that the population has are more the media, because people are very clear how they believe and what they think. What the media portrays as what people think or what's normative is quite a bit different. And so for the media to delve into something, they can. But we see that, for instance, turn on MSNBC any day of the week or CNN, they will be attacking Trump day and night, day and night, day and night. And what impact does it have? And I wonder to which degree voters care. And I think that there is a degree that voters, for those that hate him, it's sort of fun to watch them kicking this guy who they hate. But does it change anything in the population? Because those who love him still love him. And those who are ambivalent about him are still ambivalent about him. It's not changing anything. So if you're already in the crowd that likes to hear every day the punching bag of Donald Trump, you know where to tune in. If you want to hear him praised all day, you know where to tune in. But if you want objective information about this, which is what I imagine most rational voters, which there's a myth of rational voters, but most people who are interested in that, I mean, character does have a degree of validity to it, and it should be taken into it, especially when it comes to whether or not they're going to exercise their public duties per the law or not.
But Jason, let me ask the question. There's a practical one. You're right. The echo chambers, right? If I like, and just step away from politics, I like Washington Capitals hockey team. I watch Capitals. I dream Capitals or breathe Capitals, and it's the best team in the world. And nobody in the world will persuade me that Toronto Maple Leafs is a better team. No, they're not a better team, and because I love the Capitals, that's it. But in case of say, Trump or Biden, what if the negative campaigning, for example, MSNBC and CNN against Trump, it simply mobilized the voters? So if I was disinterested in Trump, I don't like him, but now I just hear negativity about him, so it would just make me more and more determined to go and vote. So maybe one of the goals of character attack is also to mobilize the base. Is it true?
See, that's a really good point. So I think that there is a degree to that. That's a really good point. And I think that this certainly does have some legitimacy. In the case of Trump, I think where the Democrats would have had a strategic advantage out of all the things that have come out about Donald Trump, the one thing that I think would have been a game changer against Trump would have been to reveal the actual state of his economic affairs. Because there is so much information, or so many people have said, alluded to, the fact that he might not actually have any money. He might be almost broke. And if that's true, and he's not the person that he's portrayed himself to be, and he's sort of a fraud, that would be the con man, to paint him as a con man, someone who has betrayed people or tricked people, I think would have been effective strategy. Because these people put hope in him. If you talk to Trump voters, they look at him, they say, but you know, this guy's amazing. Look at this businessman. He's been so successful, which we know is not true, but they believe this. If we show, well, you know, he's not a billionaire. Actually, it's borrowed money. He's borrowing people's money, and then he doesn't pay back the loans. If that were to be effectively shown to voters, I think that would have actually changed their minds. So that could have been a game changer. But as far as mobilizing voters, I think that, yes, that there is a rationale to why you would keep repeating this. But at the same time, I would imagine most people are going to tune in 5 days a week or 7 days a week to hear Trump bashing are already pretty motivated to go vote against him. I doubt that they could be further persuaded by repeating more of the same messaging.
I read the question, if you don't mind, which is quite relevant to what you said right now, right at this moment. What type of campaign you consider more effective, positive or negative, or will it depend on particular context and situation? Or can you use both strategies?
No, there's been a ton of research about it. And what I found is negative campaigning is quite a bit more effective. I mean, every poll shows that voters are strongly opposed to negative campaigning. All voters say that they don't like it. They wish it would stop. Focus groups show that as well. So it's qualitative and quantitative analysis shows that voters hate negative campaigning. At the same time, when you test in focus groups, which I have, negative campaigns and positive campaigns, infinitely more impact comes from the negative campaign than from the positive campaign. So I think that, yes, you need to have a positive campaign. I've always argued that actually in a normal campaign, you should have several lines running at the same time, which is one, you have your positive line, what you're promising America, what you're going to do for your country, the plans for the future. But at the same time, you have the attack, you know, what you're doing to drive down the numbers of your opponent. Remember, an election is just about getting more votes than your opponent. And that's even 50% of people, it's more votes than your opponent, which means if his numbers go down, the number of votes that you need to win is less. So there is a strategic reason you have to drive down his voters. And it's two reasons. One, not necessarily that they vote for you. It could be that they vote for the other party. If you're Donald Trump, you might want them to vote for the Green Party. The Democrats don't vote for Joe Biden, they vote for the Greens. Why? Simply so it's not a vote against you in the elections. So there's a calculus to this, right? But the second part of this is that you have to have a positive narrative about who you are and your reputation, your image. So when you're being attacked, you can also fight those off. So it's both building this positive image, at the same time, it is fending off attacks that come against you as a delineated strategy. So there's several levels of a campaign operating at any given time. So I would say, yes, negative and positive campaigns work both in a campaign, but quite a bit of studies have come out, really interesting ones, that have shown that, yes, negative campaigns are infinitely more impactful for voters than anything else.
But if you were advising a DNC today, would you advise them in this case, hypothetically, not to just basically buy advertisements on CNN and MSNBC, but do as much as possible on Fox News and say, and with the readers of Wall Street Journal, just go there.
Absolutely. I mean, the DNC is wasting its money to just be running negative ads about Trump on MSNBC. What can you possibly say to MSNBC viewers that they don't already believe it? I mean, they've already accepted that. For those who are Trump voters who watch Fox News, or they voted for Trump last time, there is a degree of disappointment you can play on. I mean, as I've read about Trump voters now, I haven't done any focus groups in the US, but I've read about other people's focus groups, and they show they're disappointed. You know, they expected more, that he was going to provide something, and they don't see that change. They don't feel, they like what he's saying, but they don't feel that it's personally impacted them. So if I was you, the DNC, I would go and rewrite my ads on CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox News, and One America News, or wherever else you can, to attract voters to stay home. So it's voter suppression, not voter conversion. And by making the voters stay home or to vote for the Libertarian candidate, for instance, would be a means to lessen his vote totals. And by lessening his vote totals, it makes the game easier for Joe Biden.
When you said voter suppression, you meant in psychological sense, right? Just to discourage
yes, exactly.
People just to vote and stay there. In fact, this is a very good point. Character attacks often discourage people. They can mobilize the base, but there's a limit to which you can mobilize the base. If I'm ready to vote, I'm going to vote, and just you can waste your advertisement money on me because I'm voting anyway.
Right.
And just maybe 2, 3, 4, 5% that can go. But we talk about the bipartisan system or the bipolar system in our country. But how about countries such as the Netherlands, for instance, or Belgium, in which as a politician, is a parliamentary system, you must build a coalition. And when you attack the person to your right or left, you know that you'll be working, most likely you'll be working with them tomorrow when you're elected in parliament. So that's why you need a consensus, or at least you need to get help from when you be there. So is it a difference, say, if character attacks in bipartisan systems or bipolar systems like ours, or say European systems, parliamentary democracies?
Well, that's a really good point. So I think that there's a few aspects to that. Do you really want to have a personal attack against someone that would then jeopardize your ability to create a coalition after the elections, which would then put you in the minority in parliament? No, that's not strategically wise. So, I mean, you have to then hedge your bets and be a little bit more careful how you're doing it, and probably not attack the person in the other party, but rather the ideology or the political party itself, because even if I'm a member of the Republican Party, I'm not nearly as offended if you attack the Republican Party as if you attack me personally, right? So, I mean, the ability to attack a party is very easy. There's no offense. Whereas if you attack the person, there is going to be a long-term impact. But more than that, I think that, you know, even Europe, Western Europe, the laws that they have about slander, what your party is able to produce attacking somebody has also changed. Here in the US, we're quite a free country. You could say most anything you want, attack people however you want, and just continue. But if you are in a country that does not have those laws, it's going to be much more challenging. So, I mean, I would imagine that's actually probably good for the political process, that positive messaging is the dominant reason that people vote one way or the other, not negative campaigning.
I read a question from Alex Naumov. In authoritarian, semi-authoritarian countries, are character attacks on leaders more or less effective when there is no immediate alternative to them, like Putin, Aliyev, Berdimuhamedov, and others? Are these attacks more or less potent because of this?
So I think attacks against the dictator, right? Against the authority. So against authoritarian leader, you know, it is interesting. And I've specifically in the case of Russia, which I'm most familiar with out of those countries, is that, you know, you look at the Russian opposition. And I think one of the smartest things that Alexei Navalny has done, who's a leader in the Russian opposition, as you're aware, is the videos that he's producing about the corruption of Vladimir Putin. And not him specifically, I forgive me, but those associated with him. Now, there's two really smart things about this, I think, as a strategy of political change. One is that Putin still does have enough public support, and there is enough people who would prefer him to anyone else, though his poll numbers might go down. If push comes to shove, people say, yes, I prefer Putin definitely than Navalny, no doubt. So that's the vast majority of voters. So attack somebody who they love is a mistake. To attack those around him, though, it's like, once again, attacking the party, not attacking the person. People are more receptive to that message than would be attack against Putin. Secondly, by focusing on corruption, which is Navalny's shtick, it's quite wise. Why? Because corruption means that he's stealing your money. This is no longer attack that Putin has, her name escapes me, the gymnast with whom he lives and divorced his wife. He has this affair for years. This is a guy who's leading the Orthodox revival within Russia. The fact is, it's a political show, and nobody would care. It would not have an impact on the Russian population. But the fact that the reason that your salary is only $170 a month in Volgograd is because the government is stealing your money. This money is now in the bank account of this minister. Your money is being stolen so they could build a new chalet outside of St. Petersburg. This offends people because this is, I'm living worse because he is taking my money. And if you can generate this, I think I've always believed that voters in general are, their propensity to believe messages that are envy-based, that is, I'm envious of what someone else has, or I feel that I've been cheated, this is really what you want to go for. Because I can intellectualize why something like, oh yes, it's bad that Putin has divorced his wife. That's a very sort of intellectual thing. But the fact that he stole my money and so now I can't afford medicine for my children, that becomes a much more personal battle for me. And I think that's a much more persuasive argument against a dictatorial regime.
I also noticed that, speaking of Putin and the referendum in Russia, not much of personal attacks against him, because I think, and journalists talk about this in Russia, journalists do suffer, they are jailed and they're killed for the direct references to Putin. And Navalny, probably one of the worst he could produce, is called Putin grandpa. It's sort of a derogatory a little bit, but Putin just really want to be rejuvenated and look young, but to call him grandpa is sort of a character attack. Yes, it's a slide, but people prefer to not to say anything personal and just talk about corruption. Maybe that's one of the things that work. But speaking about political campaigns, do you find the difference between character attacks on a national level and local level?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that local level attacks are probably more effective just because it's such a small audience and such a higher chance that people will personally another person. If you were to look at a city council election, the probability that you've met the city council member, the guy running for city council, is infinitely higher. It's a much broader possibility that they personally know him. And so there's a greater sensitivity to attacks. Whereas on a national level, we're talking about people that you'll probably never meet. I mean, how many Americans have met more than, have ever met their own senator, let alone two senators? Very, very few. It's a very distant thing. And that's why it's a much more squishy thing that you can move back this way and that way on a national figure. But on somebody who's a personal figure, there's a greater deal of trust involved because I know him. And once you know him and you feel betrayed through a character attack, that you find out that he's not really the person he portrayed himself to be, it's a much more direct attack against you because your trust has been hurt. You trusted the wrong person. And that's why I think the attack would probably be more successful on a local level than on a national level.
Jason, I keep reading a bunch of questions. So and the question, we discussed it last week. However, it's a question that's to you. Do you think that the bringing down statues is a form of character assassination? And you work in Ukraine, just for example. Any examples from there or Kyrgyzstan, or you can use contemporary examples?
I saw them tear down statues in all those countries. So what I can say is that there's a long history of tearing down people's statues. It's not a new recent invention of the United States. But what I think in all those cases is that, you know, strategically, I think it's not politically wise usually attack statues. And the reason is simply that you have, when you get to the point where the population is supportive enough that you have the ability to tear down statues, it means you have political capital. There's enough political capital that would allow you to realize that. But to spend that political capital to simply rename a street, tear down a sign, is that really the best use of your political capital, or should you address the underlying problems that you're interested in? And in which case, I think that you're probably better off addressing the systematic problems in the society that you're worried about, which that symbol to you represents. But the symbol, it's just symbol. It's art. It is nothing else but a statue. It is not impacting you directly. Address, use that public consensus, because it's going to be limited and it's got a short lifespan. Use that quickly to invest in whatever political change you want to do in the country, and don't focus on things that are tangential, not immediate effect. I cite the example of Ukraine. In 2014, as you recall, the Yanukovych government was overthrown. Came to power Poroshenko, who was a populist, oligarch, corrupt. But Poroshenko did not realize any systemic reforms within the population, within the economy specifically. And I think that he is will go down as one of the worst histories that Ukraine has had, far worse than Yanukovych. Now, what will this all say? One of his biggest prizes of success was the decommunization law, as they called it, which was renaming all the streets that are named after a communist leader, taking down all the placards outside of historic buildings that said, you know, whatever general Zhukov was here on a visit in 1947, they take it all down because, he was associated with communists. Well, does this really help anything? Does this really make the society better? No, I'm sure the voters, they might applaud that. And the public opinion polls would probably show that that was popular. But in the end, ask a voter, would you prefer a higher salary or better living conditions or hospitals or an education that actually teaches your kids? Or would you prefer tearing down a statue? I assure you they prefer something that directly impacts their lives. And that'd be a better investment of the use of political capital.
Well, interesting. Just to switch gears, but probably relevant. I don't recall the day when I received a letter from anybody, just basically emails, and this is a web and so streamed TV and cable. But do you think that snail mail has any future, at least these years? And who is the target of snail? And certainly talk about character attacks, but also in campaign.
So, you know, it's very interesting. So in the entire industry of campaigns, think about this. In 2016, the US spent over $1.6 billion just on state and house races. If you aggregate then the presidential elections and local elections, the US spends over $6 billion every 4 years in elections. It's amazing sums of money. And that has done a few things. One of those is that there's entire industries that pop up tailored to elections. And one of those that's most well-known and one of the most profitable is direct mail. Mail that's sent directly to your house. And as you've probably noticed through the junk literature that you get in the mail, most of it's a tax. And the reason it's a tax is it communicates an idea quickly to voters in which they immediately discard. Surprisingly enough, they have studied this at length. And so when you get a piece of mail, the tax for flip-flopping or whatever, swift-boating your opponent, when you get this ad, most ads literally have, I'm going to forget the number now, but it's less than 3 seconds is the amount of time that's seen. So if you can get the keywords like John Kerry, coward, betrayed his troops before you toss in the trash, the ad has had the impact that it was wanted to. They don't expect you to read the rest of it. In the same way, positive ads, such as John Smith for president, when you see that, the goal that everyone realizes is that you see John Smith and president before you throw in the trash. They don't expect you to read the rest of it. The goal is simply that there's name ID that develops. Because as you know, you have to contact with a voter or with a consumer about 7 times before there is an impact made for them that they remember the brand. So to be considered voting for someone, you have to first know the person exists. So the whole point of direct mail is not really about persuading you as much as to make an immediate impact on you before you toss it away. So I think that, yes, I think snail mail will continue, not because it's the best, but simply because there's an industry built around it that's going to continue pushing it forward, even if it's proven to be less effective than other means. For instance, social media is more effective. Digital ads are more effective. That's something we can prove, and much cheaper. But there's a massive industry built around this other one. So I think it will perpetuate for a long, long time.
Oh, thank you. In politics, and I use example from, say, Soviet communists, the Bolsheviks had a slogan, informal one, the worse the better. They were rooting for the defeat of their imperial government so that they can take over and just build a paradise in their country. So the worse the better. Do you think that there are people within Trump core, or at least Trump supporters, who are disgruntled with him, and now they are launching their own character attacks against him, assuming that his defeat will pave the way for a new Republican Party, say, 8 years from now? Is it possible just to have those people within campaigns or within groups of supporters?
I mean, sure, obviously. I mean, I remember that the many stories that you probably saw as well is even Michael Bloomberg's campaign, how many of the people were actually going door-to-door with Bernie Sanders' literature, though they were paid staff of the Bloomberg campaign. They had no faith that the guy could win, but they're getting paid, so they're already going door-to-door. So they tossed out the Bloomberg literature and giving out the Sanders information. Same way today, look at how many people are leaking things in the White House. By the way, which is also of concern, is how often newspaper articles today cite anonymous source, anonymous source, anonymous source, and not one of the sources ever given a name. And it might have four or five anonymous sources, but never name anyone. I think it's a very dangerous trend, and it's not defensive of Trump. I think generally it's a dangerous trend, because if nobody's willing to associate their name with something, that already says something. And it's not something that, you know, about the bombing of Cambodia under Nixon. This is about what's going on today. This is little things about gossip, about the president said this, or he ate this, or he talked to this person. Why would so many people fear to put their name to it? And if they do fear to put their name to it, is it worth circulating the public sphere? Because does that disqualify? How do we know? How do we verify? And how do we know it further? Unless somebody's willing to accept responsibility for the attack that's being made.
But I think the same thing can be said, just for sake of balance, that maybe there's some people who are identify themselves as progressives, who believe that Biden is not the best candidate, actually the worst candidate, and it's even better to have Trump four more years just to have a complete disaster, right? And then just to elect finally a true progressive candidate. So that's why probably there's some Democrats today also, not only are they reluctant, but also they may somehow subconsciously, openly launch character attacks against Biden.
There's been forever, and always in elections, there are splinters within the parties. In this election cycle, as you know, which NBC is talking about a lot, is the Lincoln Project, which is all these Republicans who are opposed to Trump. It's nothing new. In 2008, when I worked for John McCain, we had a stream of volunteers from PUMA, which was Party Unity My Ass, which was all the Hillary Clinton supporters who refused to help Barack Obama. Huge numbers. I mean, I'm not kidding. We had huge numbers of these people who were Hillary Clinton fanatics, who absolutely hated Barack Obama because they felt he attacked her too much in the election. And they were ready to help John McCain win just because they hated Barack Obama so much. And from my short conversations with them, I have no reason to believe they had any conservative sentiment or a pro-Republican feeling in their heart other than a deep hatred of Barack Obama. And so these sorts of splits within the party are nothing new. I mean, this is completely common if we look back at historic election cycles. Tea Party, the rise of them and their opposition to John McCain. We see this throughout all election cycles. So I think, yes, I have no doubt whatsoever within Trump world, there's most certainly people who would be happy to see him burn so that the party can be like a phoenix reborn. Mm-hmm.
I have two questions, and I read the last one and then switch back to Alex's question. To follow up about the mail question, I quote, "I'm hearing that left-leaning voters are taking on a campaign to disrupt Trump's campaign by sending in a check of one penny to gung up the works. Besides being questionable, is it effective?
It's probably not effective, because just think about what the impact would be. If you had, how many people are realistically going to portray that? Let's say you have 100,000 people that are portraying that. This is a campaign, once again, our election cycles are billions and billions of dollars. So in the face of billions of dollars of expenditures, and then you have all the political action committees, PACs, and everything else that are involved, what is the impact? It's nominal at best. At very best, it's nominal. And I'm sure that it's just a nuisance, but doesn't really change anything. Most of the donations are done online anyways.
A question from Alex again. Does the Russian law banning, I quote, disrespect toward the government do more harm than good for their reputation?
You know, that's actually a really good question. So I have long believed that those sorts of laws are dumb, because if you want to stay in power, you want to go through the best semblance possible that you're democratic. It's sort of like the historic examples of protest, why one succeeds, another one fails. Revolutionary protest, why Maidan, for instance, 2014 Ukraine, Bishkek, 2010 April. You go through these different protests and overthrows government, why one succeeds. Usually, if the government tolerates it and doesn't do anything, people start to go home. They will just go home, because nobody cares that much. Nobody's going to hang out in a park for 9 months. They might stick it out for a few weeks, but not for 9 months. People have to go back to work. Life continues. And so tolerating a little bit of protest, usually better off. The mistake, and what we saw in several governments have been overthrown, is that when you start, for instance, shooting the protesters, that generates then more of a backlash against the government for having done that. And so I think that the Russian government would be, if you're in the, if I was Vladimir Putin, I'd say, you know, tolerate some dissent, tolerate some of the protests. The fact is, they don't have access to mainstream media. The vast majority of the population is going to have no idea what these people think or believe. It's not going to have any impact. But let them go do that. Because if you martyr them and they become this hero of democracy, you're hurting yourself in the long term. Much wiser to let them go express themselves in YouTube, which, I mean, I've seen the government attack before, different people in opposition. A YouTube video that had 2,000 views, 10,000 views even. Who cares? Just let it go. But when you prosecute them, the views go up to millions and millions and millions of views. So was that strategically wise? No, it was not. It was much better to just let them do it and nobody will notice.
Jason, a question of all questions is that years ago, David Sears, political science professor at UCLA, told us in class that, well, the best defense against attacks against you is reattribute, say, oh, it's a politics, or she has, he has personal motivation. Besides that, so I see a negative ad, see a personal attack, oh, it's politics. In your view, besides saying, oh, it's politics, how can we defend and how can we help people defend against character attacks, against them, not only in politics, but maybe in real life?
You know, I think in general, to defend against them is difficult. And one of the best ways I think that you can do it, and I've seen it happen before, is when people are not receptive to the attack, and it creates a backlash, where people say, you know, that's really uncalled for, that's really too much, because they like the person too much, that they don't want to believe it. And that's why, for instance, books have been published about Mother Teresa attacking her, that she wasn't a saint. She was actually a terrible person for a litany of reasons. The reason those don't go very far is they create a media scandal, but the public doesn't change their opinion. They become more entrenched in their opinion and think that the person who wrote the book is awful. How could you attack Mother Teresa? I mean, how could you do something so terrible? And so the thing is, if you can generate enough of a positive image of somebody before they get attacked, I mean, it's hard to beat Mother Teresa's positive image, right? But if you can at least generate this positive image that you're a good and decent person and call out the other person, which I think is very reasonable. I think it is very, I mean, in the world of Trump, it is difficult. I understand that. In most campaigns though, if we were in any other campaign but the one that at the presidential level right now, I think if you flip it on somebody and you say, that's really intolerable, that's really terrible. You know, I'm focused on the common answers, you know, I'm focused on how we can improve the wage of workers and the rights of citizens, whatever, something about directly helping people. And this person wants to attack my family, which is by itself an attack. But you turn this on them where people will get outraged. And the outrage is no longer against you for whatever this perceived slight was, but rather against the person for launching a character attack against you. And not talking about the issues, which is the way we always phrase it in campaigns. We want to talk about the issues. We want to debate the issues and not be attacked on a personal level. And that is an effective way of changing the discourse. Where you have difficulty in the US, though, is the rise of political action committees. There are entire political action committees who will not produce anything positive in the course of an election except for attacks. And they will keep running attacks. And by law, they cannot be coordinated with the campaign. So the campaign doesn't matter what they're doing. The negative attacks can continue from the side of the political action committee.
Jason, but yes, issues is what we're supposed to talk about, but we talked about character, we discussed character. And past 3 years, 4 years now, it has been, in my view, very effective to effective for the opposition to Trump to associate his name with Russians, essentially mm-hmm. saying that Trump is a puppet in the hands of the puppeteers, the Putin, the Kremlin. But do you think that there's contemporary developments today in this, the Taliban, Afghanistan, and well, those developments associating Trump with Kremlin somehow in the minds of many, I think that for Russians is an easy target for their security services, for their paid journalists, and for them to simply do everything possible now just to create a mess in our electoral system to associate Trump with the Kremlin, and by hinting, by sending innuendos, oh yeah, Putin and Trump are in cahoots.
You know, I fully agree with you. I mean, I think that agree that Russia has become the bogeyman who we associate everything with is, I mean, it's phenomenal. It's unbelievable. It's false that Russia is somehow responsible for everything that goes wrong. I mean, you saw when the Black Lives Matter protest started and there was began looting and things like this. Said, well, you know, this is part of the Russian playbook. And I was amazed to see the degree of play that got in the national audience. Trump gets elected. Well, that's part of the Russian playbook. After I left Cambridge Analytica, I got a lot of calls from the press that wanted to talk about Cambridge. The number of questions I got about, well, were there any Russians that worked there? And I was like, this is insanity. These are data scientists. They're PhDs in physics, mathematics, who are just doing calculations. They go, but what Russians worked? And I said, this is insanity that we're trying to find a connection and force a connection, no matter how unrealistic or non-existent it might be. And I think that, yes, Russia at this point is just constantly goes back to Russia. And I think it's, you know, as you know, my view is that, yes, we can say with a sincerity, yes, Russia did hack the DNC during the 2016 elections, as they also hacked, by the way, as FBI reports it, the Republican National Committee. They just happen to really the ones from the Democratic National Committee, not the RNC. But if you say that, yes, that's true. But, you know, Russia isn't actually the reason that we have all these problems. Expenditures that they had on social media to divide Americans, which was a focus of a 2-year-long investigation, millions of dollars, expenditures were less than what we would spend. I want to say it was $50,000. Mm-hmm. We would spend more than that per day in just the state of Iowa for one out of 16 presidential primary candidates. That's nothing. $50,000. It's pennies. Remember, the election cycle is $6.8 billion. What's $50,000? And that's for the length of the total election, not even targeted to voters who are undecided. That was to the general, they're targeting people in California. The people in California are going to vote Democrat. You're not convincing any voters. The people in New York are going to vote Democrat. It's not convincing any voters. What a waste of $50,000. Completely ineffective. Completely and totally ineffective. And that was the reason that Trump won? No, that's false. That's completely false. But I think that Russia has become such a default kicking bag for everything that you can sit there and say that and people accept it at face value. And unfortunately, I think that's to the detriment of the United States in the long term for a lot of reasons. But one, because Russia does not need to be our strategic enemy for all of eternity. I think it's a big mistake that we're falling due to our national politics. We've now put that into the international stage. It's affecting our transnational politics.
Jason, we know that you got phone calls in the 5-7 minutes, but maybe just by concluding a sort of a question, what should we expect these 4 months before November? Will character attacks against Trump go beyond saying that he's a liar and the attacks against Biden go beyond that he's too old? So we know, but so anything else to expect? Something strange, something new, yeah. Something obvious.
Something more exciting. I'm sure there will be. I have no doubt whatsoever there will be. And I'm sure that there has already been a lot of time and money invested into investigating what those attacks would be. I gave it an interview just the other day. I actually don't remember who it was. But anyways, long story short is that the journalist was interesting. And she said, we started speaking. She said, so you used to live in Ukraine. I said, I did. She said, well, you know, it's really interesting. All my friends, she's a Democrat, all my friends that work for the Biden campaign are saying Ukraine is going to be really central to this election. I said, really? I'm actually surprised to hear that. Why is that? And she said, because, well, you know, there's a lot going on. I mean, if you can show that Donald Trump and remind people where he was impeached, remember, because of Ukraine, and you can bring this up and make that a big deal, this will be ours. But if Donald Trump wins this narrative and he's able to flip this into Joe Biden's supposed corruption in Ukraine and Hunter Biden and all these other things, this could really work against Joe Biden and hurt him. So it really depends on who can win the Ukraine fight. And I thought, God, I can't believe that Ukraine, which the whole time I lived there, I surprised anyone knew the name of the capital when I came to the U.S., is now for 4 years running going to be central to another U.S. campaign. But it is quite possible. I mean, there's always more to come out, and there's always going to be more people willing to talk to the press or to get their 2 minutes of fame, to sign an affidavit or go into a TV interview to attack one of the candidates. So I am absolutely, without a doubt, slightest bit of doubt, sure that there will be new attacks coming out against Joe Biden and against Donald Trump in this election cycle.
Well, Jason, our time is up, and we really appreciate your time and effort, and certainly you will be invited again.
Thanks again, Jason.
Thank you all. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.